But he'll be here. He may well have fallen asleep. I'll ring him, but we'll get started, Siobhan.
Okay. So should I start now?
No, I'm going to introduce and welcome everybody to Medical Doctors for COVID Ethics International. Whether you're watching live, whether this is your first time, whether you're watching the recording. This group was founded by Dr. Stephen Frost during the darkest days of the COVID scam responses, COVID scam, with a desire to pursue truth, ethics, justice, freedom, and health. Stephen has stood up against government and power over the years and has been a whistleblower and activist. His medical specialty is radiology. I'm Charles Coves, the moderator of this group. I'm Australasia's passion provocateur. And my jacket is red because red is the colour of passion. I practiced law for 20 years before changing career 30 years ago this month. And over the last 12 years, I've also helped parents and lawyers to strategize remedies for vaccine damage and damage from bad medical advice. I'm also the CEO of an industrial hemp company. We comprise lots of professions, including doctors, lawyers, homeopaths, journalists, scientists, filmmakers, professors, peacemakers, and troublemakers. And we're from all around the world. Many of us thought that vaccines were okay. Now many of us proudly say, yes, we are passionate anti-vaxxers. If this is your first time here, welcome and feel free to introduce yourself in the chat and where you're from. If you publish a newsletter or a podcast, or you have a radio or TV show, or you have written a book, put the links into the chat so we can follow you, promote you, and find you. Many of us understand we're in the middle of World War III. And that there are various battle lines as part of this war. Some of us believe we're in a continuation of World War II. Most of us understand the development of science and that the science is never settled. This meeting runs for 2.5 hours, after which, for those with the time, Tom Rodman runs a video telegram meeting. Tom puts the links into the chat if you can join. We listen to Shimon Yanovitz, our guest presenter, for as long as Shimon wishes to speak, and then we have Q&A. Stephen Frost, via long-established tradition, asks the first questions. There is no censorship. It's a free speech environment with appropriate moderating. Free speech is crucially important in our fight to preserve our human freedoms. If you're offended by anything, be offended. We are genuinely not interested. We reject the offense industry that requires nobody to say anything that may offend another. We come with an attitude and perspective of love, not fear. Fear is the opposite of love. Fear squashes you. Love expands you. If you have a solution or a product or links or resources that will help people, put the details into the chat. The meeting is recorded and is uploaded onto the Rumble channel. And now welcome to Shimon Yanovitz, our guest presenter. For those of you who don't know him and you're watching this recording, his details are in the description on the Rumble channel. And Shimon, we thank you for giving us your time, wisdom, and insights. And thank you again, Stephen Frost, for creating this group and for organizing Shimon to be with us today. Ah, there you are, Stephen. Lovely to see you. Okay, Shimon, over to you.
Thank you, Charles. And welcome. Hello, everybody. Thank you for welcoming me, for giving me this opportunity to speak. So what do I want to talk about today? Basically, I have been active in researching the COVID scam from its inception till today, and research into what is called the COVID-19 vaccines by mistake, and I call them injectables because obviously they are not vaccines. So it became apparent to me that there were so many lies that we were being told, and the globalist narrative was so much in the background, you know, with all this torture and the World Economic Forum in the background, and this Great Reset. And I'm also an expert on 5G electromagnetic radiation, which has some implications into this thing. And I guess all of you know or recognize that the deployment, the unprecedented deployment of 5G infrastructure was in tandem with the progression of the so-called pandemic, which is a pathetic term. So my goal was to make some sense and order into all of this and plow through the fake narratives and the lies and the propaganda and try to present some cohesive explanation and description of what's going on. So let me, I would like to talk about two parts. Part one is what might have happened during the COVID outbreak without regard to the injectables. Was there or was there not any novel pathogen or disease or whatever? And the second part is what happened right after the commencement of the so-called vaccination campaign, what's in the vaccines or the injectables, as I like to call them, and what's going on. So if I linger too much, please tell me. If I need to be reminded of the time, please also tell me. So I want to jump straight to the beginning of this pandemic thing, and I want to tell you what I think might have happened. And let me just find the screen I want to share. Yeah, there it is. So we know that when COVID was declared by this organization that is called the WHO, there were many of us who did not agree that there was a pandemic at all. In fact, it seemed to like a fraudulent totalitarian globalist agenda. But some people were saying that they were getting sick. We know that some people were driven to bankruptcy and maybe some to suicide, and some people's livelihoods was taken away from them. And there was torture. There were police, you know, beating people up in many places, including my Israel, for not wearing masks and all these horrible things. And there were the lockdowns. And people were, we know that because we have testimonies. People were connected to ventilator machines, and then they were administered drugs such as midazolam or remdesivir, and which finished them off. And many people questioned at all whether there was ever a need to ventilate anybody. And things that were supposed to be SARS, you know, a severe acute respiratory syndrome, resulted in many people having long COVID, which has neurological symptoms, unrelated at all to any respiratory issues. So what was going on? I want to say that what I'm going to present is not a definite proof, but it's a plausible explanation. Also in the second part, I want to say, and this is a great opportunity to say this, I was able to confront the late Professor Arne Burkhardt in a meeting. I think it was 4 weeks ago or a bit more, and tell him that, you know, he's been presenting to us great images from autopsies accompanied by some brown dye that is supposed to detect the so-called spike protein, and we saw extensive tissue damage. But I wasn't at all sure about the spike protein part. So I told him that I think that there are multiple proteins being involved. Some are perhaps responsible for what is called as the blood clots of the embalmers, which he was the first ever pathologist in the world to acknowledge the existence of. And he surprisingly agreed with me. This makes sense and needs to be tested. And 2 weeks later, he was dead. So I think that it's not without risks that we are doing all of this. And I don't stick and I don't adhere to the official narrative. On the contrary, I try to break the official narrative and show through it. And this is not without risk. So I'm a little bit nervous, but hopefully we'll do this and we'll prevail. Let me go to the presentation. So there are a few things that are worrying. Well, maybe before I do that, let me go to here. Okay, so this is a paper from Nature, you know, most prestigious magazine maybe on the planet, prestigious in quotes. And this is from 2006, so manuscript was 2005. And this is what they tell us. This paper, huge grand paper, is about bacteria in gene therapy, and subtitle bactofection versus alternative gene therapy. So what I want to show you here basically is that they have been researching for a long time, because this is from 2005, how to infect and transfect humans and maybe other mammals with bacteria. And this is very important because I'm a member of the group of scientists that completely deny the existence of any such thing called a virus, except in its Latin meaning, which means poison. But some people believe in some fake particles and so on. That are pathogens, no less. So let me show you how easy it is to take bacteria, which are not pathogens in nature, by the way, and in the lab, with the help of things called plasmids, make them pathogens. And these plasmids are more important because of the late findings of Kevin McKernan, who found plasmids in the COVID-19 injectables. So what is alternative gene therapy? It's the bacteria are used for gene transfer or disease transfer, and I'm going to show you how they're doing it. So basically, you have two models here. This one, figure one, is the first model. You take bacteria A, and these bacteria are carefully selected to be non-pathogens so that the body doesn't fight very hard against them, let them in easily. And you include plasmids that are very carefully designed. And these are the three circles here. Plasmids are always cyclic structures of genetic material, DNA. So you put these plasmids into bacteria. Bacteria, by the way, are an organism in nature that works and uses plasmids. The only one. Only bacteria use them. And these plasmids are genetic material independent of the own genome, or the original genome of the bacteria. And it is it multiplies independently of the original genome. So in this model number one, they take bacteria, which is A here, and this is a human cell. And somehow in B, the bacteria penetrates the cell. Remember, it's not designed to be a pathogen. So here the bacteria is already in the cell. And in C, the bacteria undergoes lysis inside the cell and leaves the three plasmids free. And then these three plasmids integrate into the cell's own genome here. And then this character, whatever it is some new protein or proteins, because they're, every plasmid could theoretically code for multiple proteins. So new proteins are being produced by the host cell that has been transfected by these bacteria. Here is model, the second one, in figure two, and you see the original bacteria as in figure one. But in this case, there is a second path, this one, in which the bacteria do not actually enter the cells, but rather they remain in the interstitial fluid between the cells, and they simply express these proteins by these plasmids, as you can see by these characters now being outside of the cell as opposed to here. So basically what we have here is a very simple and effective method of either manipulating the genome of human cells or producing any number of proteins, including toxic proteins, inside the human body, independent of any what's called gain of function or gain of fiction or viruses or any such other rubbish. And I want you to see, where is it? They've been experimenting with many different kinds of bacteria. This table two here is studies bactofection in disease models. So bactofection could cause disease, but there are also alternative gene therapy. So, you know, this research is, you know, all for the good of humanity, and they want to make us all feel better. And then they use this advanced GMO bacteria for the good. And I wanted to pay specific attention to this E. coli thing, because it would be a recurring motif. This E. coli bacteria seem to be very good and to lend themselves very easily and readily to this sort of manipulation. And last thing about this that I want to show you is this table here, table one. It's a comparison between three vector types. And the first vector type is a viral vector. That's a virus. That's the thing that I claim. By the way, I didn't start this claim. I'm a humble student of many good other researchers who've been claiming that viral vectors do not actually exist. My contribution has started, I think, about 2 years ago, when I did the research and video on the Spanish flu, in which I showed that the Spanish flu, which was not Spanish and was not a flu, was created by toxic injections. Despite, and I show in that video and research, there was a great effort by one Anthony S. Fauci in 2006, 2007, and something like that. Around that time, he became very active in trying to assert that the Spanish flu that was created by toxic injections was in fact brought about by some kind of pathogen, which he called the H1N1 flu virus. And not only that, but only a year later, in 2009, there was an outbreak of what is called the swine flu, which is the H1N1 virus that he wrote two papers about relating to the Spanish flu of 1918, no less. So My point is that we have been lied to continue for at least 100 years. In fact, a lot longer. I think it was since the days of Edward Jenner and Louis Pasteur. Louis Pasteur, who actually invented a non-existent disease, which is called rabies, and even developed a vaccine, in quotes, for that disease. And he experimented with it on children. He killed 10 of them in the process. And gladly, let me just stop the share for a while. So gladly, humans are very rarely, if ever, given rabies vaccines, in quotes. But maybe some veterinarians do, and I suggest that they stop doing that because it's pure toxin, as are all vaccines, in quotes. And I just showed you that whatever, by some fallacy, is called a virus, could easily be caused by toxic injections or by bacterial transfection, and these bacteria are very easy to manufacture. In fact, I didn't study biology, but only by myself many years after I finished my main field of expertise, and I know that even in high school nowadays, pupils can take bacteria and insert plasmids into them, experimenting with the nice new proteins that they can manufacture. And in fact, Jerry Brady, is he here? If not...
Not yet.
Not yet. So Jerry Brady brought to my attention that, you know, the things like such as insulin, which is a protein, it's a hormone, are manufactured industrialized manufacturing of these proteins exactly by this bacterial and plasmid method. You take bacteria, you put the genes into them to start manufacturing insulin, and then you harvest the insulin, and voila, you have the insulin that you can use as a product for the good of humanity. What if the coding genes code for some toxic peptides or protein? By the way, peptides are the simplest form of proteins. They're just a chain of amino acids. So this is very easy to do. And I suggest that maybe they have been trying to play with it before the COVID injectables were rolled out, because they did want to create the impression that there was something, you know, a new viral pathogen, a coronavirus SARS-CoV-2, which of course we know does not exist. How do we know that? Because nobody has ever been able to demonstrate its existence. But not only that, nobody has ever been able to demonstrate the existence of any virus or viral particle. And that is contrary to exosomes, which originate in the cells themselves and are such particle, but they're used for altogether other things, for some communication between cells and between organisms. And they are not pathogens, and they don't infect. In fact, they come from within. So this is what could have happened before the rollout of the injections. And it wasn't very successful, was it? Because although some people might have gotten ill and maybe even died, the majority of the population, you know, is very peaceful. And this is very simple to explain. Even if you take such bacteria, and let's say you spray them from the air on, you know, on the entire planet, what happens to these bacteria in the wild, as opposed to in the petri dish or otherwise in the lab? These are live bacteria, so they are alive. They change, they evolve, and they maybe have some will. And you you know, you designed and planned them with some intention and you wanted them to do something, but after you release them to the wild, they're on their own. They can do things other than what you've planned. And this is why we saw, for example, there was this famous press conference with President Donald Trump and Anthony S. Fauci, and then there was Deborah Birx. And she said, how lucky are we that we live in an age where incoming death certificates are in digital form, so we can change them after they've arrived. So we change them. And what do we write? We write, if we think there is a reason to change, like, for example, a person died in a car accident, but we think maybe the person died with COVID. So we changed the death certificate to say that he died with COVID. Why was there a need to falsify all these death certificates, right? And I can show you, but I won't do it now because the time is short. Footage, or many footages, you know, of just completely deserted emergency wards and hospitals and tents and whatever, erected for COVID. That's before the injectable, and completely deserted. And they were trying very hard to push the maybe 15 centimeters sticks to the noses of people. And I won't get into this now, but these brittle hairs, the tip, were the earliest form of actually introducing foreign materials to people. And that wasn't good. And we all know, of course, about the fake PCR tests. I won't get into that, but they made a great effort to create the impression that there was a deadly virus running rampant and maybe going to wipe out humanity. But there wasn't, right? However, the power of mainstream media is so big. I don't watch television, maybe sports a little bit. I think I said that once. But people who, you know, religiously watch the news bulletins, they must have thought that the skies were falling down and that the planet was exploding, something like that. And I will, you know, sometimes I looked outside my window to see bodies piling up in the streets. I couldn't see these. So whatever this very deadly virus was, it was clear to me that its habitat was mainstream television only. And this is when things got really ugly, because some guy by the name of William Gates III, who is the chief immunologist or vaccinologist of the world, has declared normalcy does not return until we've vaccinated at large the entire world population. So he was calling the shots, right? This William Gates III has decided that we, all of us, 8 billion people, need to be injected with these injectables that he was responsible for the development of, allegedly. We know that that wasn't the case. This is a military operation. And it had some names. In the US, it was called Warp Speed and so on. And then they told us, all you need is, you know, just one shot and normalcy returns, right? No, let's make it two shots separated by 3 weeks or something like that. And one portion was two doses, and then the narrative quickly changed to, oh, you need boosters. So this is ongoing, and then things really started to get ugly because people started to die en masse, and they're still dying to this day from injections that they might have received 2 years ago or 1 year ago. People are still dying. sometimes athletes on the playing field are just collapsing and just dying just like that. Pilots are, you know, it's good that we have two of those, because sometimes one is dying mid-flight. This is what's going on, and I think I know what is happening, and I want to show this to you. Let me go back to sharing, and so what is actually happening here? So here is one approach. One approach is that the narrative is in fact true, and there are mRNA lipid nanoparticles. And that they are responsible for the production of spike protein, although I showed you that bacteria could do that much better. That reminds me, maybe I'll go back to this table. So you can see in this table very clearly that bacterial vectors, right? This is viral, and non-viral is the lipid nanoparticles. These bacterial vectors by far have the simple production, simple delivery, and largest amount of delivered DNA. What they don't have is no safety and no efficacy. And we know that this is indeed the case. So this seems to be closer to the model than this fake narrative of mRNA. But I don't think it's entirely fake, but I'll get to that. So
Jim, I'll just note on that table, it wasn't efficacy, it was efficiency, interestingly.
Yes, thank you. Thank you so much for correcting me, Charles. Efficiency. So the efficiency is low, hence, when it's sprayed from the skies, as opposed to injected into the veins, they don't produce a very deadly disease. And that's exactly what we saw. And that's in accordance. Thank you for the correction, Charles. So you, it's very simple, it's very readily, prepared. And then it's not safe, but it's not very efficient. You need...
So, Shimon, just to be clear, is that a misprint in the paper? It is it?
I'm sorry?
So just to be clear for people watching now and later, is that a misprint in the paper?
No. The paper is right. It's describing this method.
Yeah, but what... So, okay. So what do they mean by efficiency?
I guess that by efficiency, they mean how successful are these bacteria in actually creating either a disease or a genetic manipulation as compared to other means. For example, lipid nanoparticles, the non-viral vectors. So lipid nanoparticles injected to the vein, of course, are very safe because you only kill the injected, you don't kill the non-injected. But also not very efficient. And then there is this fictitious viral vectors that are very unsafe and very efficient in creating this either a disease or, and this is in accordance to these two tables, this is the disease model. And then there is the gene therapy model. They call gene therapy, but I don't think they have this therapy in mind. So I just want you to know that they have been busy for decades working on this to transfect humans with bacteria. So what is the one thing that they tell us when there is an outbreak of something? A virus. Why don't you tell us the truth that you've been working for decades on using bacteria to bring about disease? It's not very efficient, but you've been doing it all the same. This is Nature magazine. This is not some kind of, godforsaken journal. This is the journal.
Well, Shimon, so is that a real question, or is it are you just asking it as a statement?
No, it's a rhetorical question.
Rhetorical, yeah.
Obviously, the virus.
Maybe the answer is that they know that antibiotics exist.
Well, they sure know, and there was at least one famous medical doctor. I think Didier Raoult from Marseille in France, who came up with this protocol of, I think, the worthless hydroxychloroquine. But he combined it with an antibiotic, azithromycin, which is very effective against bacteria. Mind you, if you kill bacteria, you can still have their plasmid spill into the body, thereby creating the Herxheimer reaction of some, you know, disease. So you need to be very careful.
Shimon, it might be in their interest to work with bacteria, but to play down the bacteria because they got antibiotics, and play up viruses because then they can push the vaccinations.
Get it? Absolutely, absolutely, Stephen. So they couldn't have used viruses because there is no such thing. But that's the narrative that they have played, because the entire purpose was to get to the injectables and then to push them. And then you have to induce fear and terror in the hearts of everybody in the world and torture them in the process, so they will be willing to line up and lend their deltoid muscles for the poisoned needle, right? This was, I suggest, the entire thing.
But so we know that bacteria are dangerous. I think we agree that they exist.
Bacteria.
Yeah, but we've got antibiotics. So that's a problem for them, because they can't use vaccines against bacteria, but they can use them against viruses, or so they say. But of course, we know that deadly, even if you accept that viruses exist, which I'm not sure I do, you've still got the problem that deadly pandemics are not possible, because a deadly virus kills its host. So yeah. A pandemic cannot occur. But they want to push that all the time. And that's why I think it's very important to have an opinion about the gain of function narrative, which they're pushing at every opportunity.
And I think, Stephen, that they are planning to continue pushing this with future fictitious pandemics such as Marburg or monkeypox or whatever, or Ebola or whatever other toxins they are going to push, and then push their respective vaccines upon us or injectables. But I want to stress, Stephen, that even the bacteria are naturally not dangerous. It's the GMO plasmids that they have put into them that confer the toxicity. These are harmless bacteria. For example, E. coli, which is in the intestines of each and every one of us, they did manipulate. They did give some gain of function to the E. coli, because I happen to have a first-hand experience of a respiratory E. coli infection. So E. coli used to be an anaerobic bacterium that could live only in the intestines. And in the past, quite a few years before COVID, there were multiple instances of respiratory E. coli diseases. Not very fatal, but still you needed to use. So how did E. coli turn from anaerobic bacterium to an aerobic one? But again, when it's in our intestines, not only is it harmless, maybe it's very needed, maybe it's essential to our health, because bacteria in our guts have tasks that they do for us. So they can utilize these bacteria as a vector, as a platform, for insertion of some payload, but this payload is not natural. This is an important point. Now, if you can use antibiotics, which obviously they don't want us to use, I'm going to show that by the time that people got injected, antibiotics are worthless. But at that time, they were probably could have been very effective. But still, caution should be applied, because when you kill bacteria and it has toxins within it, there is something that's called a Gerrish-Herxheimer reaction of the die-off. It's too quick, and then you can get some poisonous reaction.
But Shimon, that's very important what you just mentioned there, because they did play down antibiotics in what was supposed to be a deadly viral pandemic, respiratory viral pandemic. But the point is, they completely ignored what we learned at medical school, which, and later, you know, it was kind of kept going, which was that I've forgotten the, carry on. Sorry, I remember, it'll come back.
Okay. please remember this question for later. Let's move on. So then the injectables came, and I wanted to know what in the injections was killing people. So there is this initial narrative, and there is this paper that claims that it's not even the mRNA, but it's rather the platform itself, the delivery platform, which is the, how do I get rid of this? The platform of the lipid nanoparticles, this is the one that...
Shimon, the thing I was trying to remember, a secondary bacterial infection, when you've got a viral infection, there's always a danger of secondary bacterial infection because of many factors, I think. But anyway, the point is that, so it's not true to say that you shouldn't give antibiotics to people who are suffering from a viral infection.
There is no such thing. Yeah, there is no such thing as a viral infection, but your comment or your question is so valid, because this was exactly the subject matter of the two fraudulent papers written by Anthony Fauci back in 2007 and then in 2008. In 2007, he claimed that the Spanish flu was caused by the H1N1 flu virus. And then there was an uproar behind the scenes, so he wrote this correction paper in 2008, and he said, okay, all these people who died did not die from the H1N1 virus. In fact, they died from a secondary bacterial infection. And this is Anthony Fauci's words, not mine or yours, Stephen. So theoretically, antibiotics could have saved them. But
I just want to stress
that even... He was not telling the truth even in the second paper, because what really killed them were toxins. There is no such thing as viruses at all. Bacteria, of course, exist, but there is no bacterial infection. Bacteria do not infect. They do not cause inflammation. There are natural parts. There's bacteria all around us. Nothing happens unless you load them with toxins. This is the main point. So it wasn't, but yeah, answering your question, there is this narrative of a secondary bacterial infection. And if, as I show here, if indeed bacteria are weaponized, then potentially antibiotics could play a vital role in treating these people. And it did, because Professor Didier Raoult treated them with azithromycin. And it was very effective. And they tried to fire him for that. He also used hydroxychloroquine, which I think is totally worthless. But the azithromycin certainly worked. Does this answer the question, Stephen?
Well, the reason I was mentioning it was there was a whole narrative whereby the newly qualified doctors hardly dared to give antibiotics because they would be criticized by the regulatory bodies and whatever, you know, their own consultants for not identifying the bacterium. But we learned at medical school that sometimes there wasn't time, or the very if you've got bacterial meningitis, then, you know, I'm beginning to wonder whether anything's true that we were taught now. But if you've got bacterial meningitis, then you've got 6 hours, you know, and in a young child, you know, and in a baby, you've got less than 6 hours. So you can't hang around waiting for results to know for certain which antibiotic to give. You give them prophylactically, but that was discouraged. And so there was a war against antibiotics, which I haven't heard anybody talking about in the last 3 years, but I just remembered with you talking about bacteria.
Indeed, there was.
And,
Indeed, there was a war against antibiotics. Stephen, I think that you and we all should probably unlearn a large portion of what you learned in medical school, because I think a lot of it was fake. But I think in the case of weaponized bacteria, prophylactic antibiotics could be very effective. And in fact, this professor Didier Raoult from Marseille did just that. He gave people azithromycin. So the establishment started proceedings against him to get him out of his job, and of course forbade any use. And doctors, you're absolutely right, Stephen. Doctors were discouraged from prescribing azithromycin. Instead, remdesivir was preferred, and ventilators and such means that...
Correct.
You know, so there was a war against the use of antibiotics in any of this.
So, Shimon, I was looking after my patients, and I was giving the antibiotics anyway, because I thought that if I was in their position, and there was a chance of getting a secondary bacterial infection, and by the time that the newly qualified doctor had discovered the bacterial infection, it's too damn late. You're dead. So you need to act in advance quite often in medicine, well, in life as well.
I believe, Stephen, that you did the right thing, as did Didier Raoult. The only point I want to make is that I believe that it wasn't a secondary bacterial infection. It was a primary bacterial infection, as you can see per this paper.
Absolutely.
And also, I wouldn't call it an infection. I would call it a bacterial assault, because these were bacteria that were preloaded with a toxic payload. Actually, the payload itself wasn't toxic, but it was the genetic material for the production of the toxins. So I believe...
Another thing that's just occurred to me, Shimon, we've got to the stage now where they've so thoroughly discredited doctors and medicine that we haven't got the language to discuss the damn thing. So now you and I are on the same side, but we can't actually agree on, I have no kind of strong belief, you know, which words should be used, but we're struggling to find the words to discuss the question. It's absolutely crazy. Rather like the trans agenda, you know, that's been introduced to create confusion, and it's created so much confusion that nobody can discuss it because it's too dangerous, because they might offend someone. And then they'll get attacked on Twitter or some other nonsense.
Right. So I'm with you on that, Stephen. And isn't it strange, Stephen? I thought it's kind of strange that I'm not a medical doctor. And it seems to me, I started asking these questions like 2 years ago, and it seems to me that I was talking to myself because I had no audience. And not to mention what I found later in the injectables. And I think that it's about time that we have this discussion. And I'm very happy that we are. I think John Baudouin, I'm sorry, I don't know. You made some gestures with your hand. Was there something urgent that you wanted to say?
Oh, no. When you guys were talking about the bacterial infection, I posted some graphs in the chat. The COVID respiratory codes, viral pneumonia and pneumonia unspecified all have the same exact shape. They all went down from 20, and this is Massachusetts, which is every place is different. They all went down in the exact same shape. Bacterial pneumonia, however, did not have that same shape. It was very different. And it stayed high in 21 and 22. So given that if COVID was a viral pathogen, I'm not contradicting you. I'm saying if it was a viral pathogen, it should have diminished in the second year and even more in the third year, like it did with COVID, like it did with regular viral pneumonia, but it did not with bacterial pneumonia. So I think two things happened, and I can't prove anything, but here's my guess. In 2020, they withheld antibiotics based on the CDC recommendations. And in my presentation, I have a link to the CDC page where still to this day, there's not the single mention of the word antibiotic anywhere on the page in how to treat COVID. And so withholding antibiotics killed a lot of people in that first year of 2020, but it's not the same thing that happened in 21 and 22. I think the immune mechanism was damaged by the vaccines in 21 and 22, and that's why you have so many bacterial pneumonia deaths in 21 and 22. That's not what I wanted to say, but I said that because I couldn't remember what I wanted to say.
Okay, I didn't get to the injectables yet. I see that we have a very woke discussion, and that's good. So there is no such thing as bacterial pneumonia. Although you often find bacteria in people who have pneumonia. The reason why you have pneumonia in the first place is because of toxins. And that's pretty true for pretty much every single disease. So if the lung tissue becomes injured by some toxins that are inhaled, and God knows, and you know, that there are enough toxins in the air to cause such damage, then the tissue breaks, and then you can get all sorts of growth there, such as bacteria and fungi. You can't get viruses because they don't exist. But it's very important for the establishment to preserve this notion of infectious disease. In fact, what is the job of nice person, Anthony S. Fauci? He heads the Office for Allergies and Infectious Diseases. So when you're talking about bacterial pneumonia, other people, and I didn't start with it, but I fully agree with those other people. Other people are talking about toxic damage to the lung tissue, followed by harmless organisms trying to break up this dead tissue, as they always do with dead tissue. Right. But anyway, if the pathogen, if these bacteria are in fact armed with plasmids that code for toxins, then it could be perceived as bacterial pneumonia. But what I wanted to say, very interestingly, is many people, including myself, and I was, I think, poisoned, but that was already 21. So after 2020, I was very well, as were most people in the world during 2020. Some people who were hospitalized and even ventilated did not have any pneumonia. What they had was low blood oxygenation. But the low blood oxygenation, as I'm going to show, is caused by entirely different reasons altogether. No pneumonia. So the SARS, severe acute respiratory syndrome, was in fact toxicity in the blood. It caused blood clots and rouleau formations and the stickiness of the blood that made the blood incapable of conducting oxygen very well. So these are all very important things that we are talking about. And I think it's about time that someone talked about them.
But Shimon, another thing that's very important. So they were talking about low oxygen levels down to 80, I think, and ridiculous numbers like that. But they never talked, no one ever talked about cyanosis, either peripheral or central, which is what we were taught at medical school. No one ever talked, that was real medicine, but these things that you clip on your fingers, that's new medicine. And we were warned against that when I was a medical student and after. So isn't that interesting? No one ever talks about cyanosis. Have you ever heard anyone talking about
cyanosis? We're going to let Shimon finish his presentation, or we're going to have a 10-way conversation.
Yeah.
Well, I think that Shimon has said, Charles, that he welcomes the input, as long as it's not too much, because then we can have a conversation, because actually that is more important than the presentation. I don't know whether you think that, Shimon.
There is a presentation.
People want to hear the presentation, not the conversation, and then questions at the end. Rose is desperate to make a comment. John's desperate to make a comment. So either we listen to Shimon's presentation or we don't.
Right. So
we're doing both, Charles.
I agree. I actually agree with both of you. So maybe I have a lot of material. Maybe it would be wise to break this into two sessions. But yeah, we need to go through some more. But we can have this discussion. I can pause at some point and we can have all these questions discussed. So I think that this is... I certainly was asking all these questions, but I couldn't see anyone else asking these questions or discussing these things. And I was trying to give answers. And this is my research, my humble attempt to contribute something to humanity for the past 3 years. So this is all before the rollout of the crown, in the jewel in the crown, the C19 injectables. And let's see what happened then. So then people really started to die and get sick. And there were not only respiratory problems, you know, there was this suddenly, after the rollout of the injectables, there was a new narrative. We are no longer dealing with SARS-CoV-2. We have variants. We have alpha, beta, gamma, delta, omicron, all these nonsense. And ridiculous British health minister, what's his name, was caught on camera saying we created the Omicron or Delta narrative because, and then he was in another show talking about the
Matt chip. Hancock.
Matt Hancock, thank you. Yeah, I should better not forget his name. He's a significant figure. So let me go back to what happened when they were rolling out the injectables. So people started to die and are still dying. And they're going to continue with these cycles of non-converging series of pandemics and viruses unless we put a stop to it and decide that we no longer succumb to this nonsense. And some people started to speculate, and they were right, that the very delivery system, even if you forget this nonsense of mRNA, the lipid nanoparticle platform in itself, if it is true, is highly toxic. And this is what this paper is all about. So you're trying to inject people with something, the delivery platform for which is toxic. And here is a graphic, I'll show you the highlights, the graphical abstract. So when they injected only the delivery platform to mice and rats, they started to die like crazy. Let's see if there is anything interesting. So if you're interested, this is tissue samples from these dead animals. So they found that these lipid nanoparticles are very toxic, and they create all sorts of death. Let's see if I can quickly refresh my mind. Let's go to the abstract. Intradermal and intramuscular injection of the led to rapid or robust inflammatory responses characterized by massive neutrophil infiltration, activation of diverse inflammatory pathways, and production of various inflammatory cytokines and chemokines. And some responses in the lung, and resulted in high mortality rate. So this is the delivery platform for these the generation of COVID injectables, which is a toxic concoction. And I also want to show you the work of this gentleman. I had the maybe he was on this show also, or this meeting. His name is Dr. Gabriele Segala. And he has this video, which I'm not going to show you because it's long, in which he analyzes the toxicity of the lipid nanoparticles and comes to the conclusion that they were designed to be toxic and to cause injury and inflammation and so on. But I came to the conclusion that this is not the main cause of mortality. And this is quite simple to argue, because had these lipid nanoparticles been so toxic, and they are, we should have seen people getting very sick and dying within hours and days. We do see that sometimes. But this cannot explain why some people go about their business healthy for a year or so or more, and then they drop dead suddenly a year later. This is not well explained by this model of the toxic delivery platform. So I needed to understand better what is the better model for explaining that. And this is the rest of my presentation. So what is the cause of all this toxicity? I'm having a rather banal problem. The battery of my mouse just died, so I will need to take a few minutes to find a replacement battery. And this always happens at the least convenient times. Doesn't it?
Okay. Imagine what it's going to be like when we have no electricity.
Yeah. And this could happen sometime soon, couldn't it? Is there a way to exit presentation mode?
Yes, I can take you out of presentation mode. Just one second.
Not presentation, just screen share mode.
Yeah. There you are.
Okay. Great. So I'm going to, please excuse me, I'm going to find a replacement battery and I'll be back.
Okay. All right. We'll entertain ourselves. Rose. Rose has been keen to make a comment, or Jim, either of you, you've got hands up, or Stephen, or anyone.
Hi, it's Rose. I'm going to challenge a few of the statements because, again, I think it's nice when people bring things to the table, but now we need to get into a little bit of expansion debate mode. So I'm going to take a step back and first talk about in the U.S., I have been fighting the antibiotic abuse, especially with Z-Packs being given out like candy, with the creation of drug resistancy, that if you look at gastrointestinal publications, that resistance can last over 2 years. So I'm going to start with that, because I actually asked a leading business analytics company to do a correlation with the rise of the C. diff we were seeing, and they refused to do it. So we've got massive, massive antibiotic abuse going on. So now that we jump into the COVID arena, I saw a publication on the pharmacological breakdown of HCQ of how it was being effective because they were seeing that the oxygen was being prohibited from attaching to the heme. And HCQ was helping with that mechanism. And I'm like, well, wait a minute. This is a desaturation problem. If I found this article and I see this, why are they building ventilators? So I'm going to completely disagree that people weren't paying attention, that it's a desaturation versus a lack of oxygenation problem. And I spoke with Dr. Jensen very early on, who, you know, he first came out that they were altering the death certificates and pushing to be for COVID. And the good clinicians that know how to do clinical documentation were treating the symptoms like altitude sickness. So the good doctors across the country were treating desaturation and not lack of oxygenation. So jump forward, I was trying to say, wait a minute, if it's impacting organs differently, could there be a common mechanism at play? And so I jumped into a deep dive with nitric oxide, because that's the great signaler to all of the symptoms we were seeing as far as platelets, cardiac issues, breathing, neuro, ovaries, because it was consolidating in five main organs especially. And so in doing a deep dive with that, I found an obscure article by a PA in Colorado who was working in the ER. And so I called him up on the phone and he said, yeah, we give nitric oxide for the ARDS we were seeing in the patients, but we were also giving L-arginine and we were finding that they were getting better. And our L-arginine goes through a two-step process for the creation of nitric oxide. And he said, do you know of the Albert Einstein Institute? And I said, no. He goes, well, here is their paper. And early on in Italy, they did a double-blind placebo study in hospitalized patients. And they found that they were able to decrease hospitalizations from 46 to 20 days by giving them L-arginine. So
hospitalizations due to what, Rose? Hospitalizations due to what, Rose?
The COVID patients.
There were no COVID patients. There was no disease called COVID-19.
Well, the point is these people then with whatever symptoms that they were presenting with, there is a lot of information out there regarding the L-arginine for nitric oxide production.
But you just quoted a scientific paper then saying that it reduced the hospitalizations or increased or whatever. It doesn't matter because there were no hospitalizations due to COVID-19 because there was no disease called COVID-19.
Then there whatever they were...
There was no deadly pandemic. There was no deadly...
Whatever they were treating with the desaturation, etc., it was helping people and getting them better. So if you want to say it wasn't COVID-19, that it was something else, whatever we want to call this, my point being is that L-arginine and addressing nitric oxide and not antibiotic use was getting people better.
My point, Rose, is that the whole thing, the whole war on antibiotics plays into their narrative. So I'm just asking questions.
Yeah. So number one, I would say in the U.S., we've been battling the absolute abuse of antibiotics with the increase of resistance.
Yes, and then Rose, it's a fine balance. You say absolute abuse of antibiotics, but actually, you know as well, are you a medical doctor?
My background is critical care nursing, and then I've been in business analytics and a health systems consultant.
So you're not a doctor then? Okay. So you're not a doctor. Okay.
So I'm dismissive as a critical care nurse who's done massive research for years on the business analytics of the abuse of antibiotics. I'm a healthcare consultant.
Very good.
And so I've got primary knowledge of the abuse of the...
So what would you say to my assertion that there was no
symptom, which was pathognomonic for a novel respiratory viral disease, a new one, a novel one, deadly as well.
The issue was in when people are saying that it wasn't necessarily respiratory, but desaturation problem, which is heme. That's blood, not respiratory. So by putting people on ventilators, that didn't remove the desaturation issues. And just to give you a, I had firsthand knowledge where I had a retired nurse call me in desperation after 9 weeks of her being killed. I drove over and rescued her. She was desaturating on 5 to 6 liters of oxygen after 9 weeks. She would desaturate to like 80, 82, walking maybe 20 feet. I rescued her, put her on a proper regime and diet. And after 9 weeks of not helping her, I was able to reduce her oxygen to 3 liters. And then within 7 days, I was able to get her off of oxygen. So I am speaking from primary experience.
All right. We're not going to...
So you sound, but you sound
on,
very...
Hang on. We've had the view...
So the thing about medicine, Charles, no. The thing about medicine, Rose, is that it's extremely complicated. We're mere human beings trying to solve problems which were created by something much larger than us. Some people call that God. So you sound extremely certain of what you say, and you're very certain of what, you know, you're quoting these papers, your conclusions of it. I'm not sure of anything any longer. I know that we've been lied to, and we were lied to for many years, as I'm coming to understand.
Good.
And the whole
Rose has expressed the view. We're not going to resolve it here. We've got Shimon back with his mouse. So let's go and keep your hand up, Rose. We've got
all
Jim
I'm
and
saying,
Rose
Charles,
next.
Is that there are too many people, doctors included, who are far too certain about what has gone on.
Excellent.
I didn't say I am giving pieces of information that are broader for exploration. I'm not saying anything with absolute certainty in one way or the other. I'm not going to tell you that there aren't viruses. I'm not going to say that they're plasmids. That stuff is all over my head.
But you're saying that your anecdotes.
Okay, all right.
Can I please comment on this? So nowadays, pretty much every scientific, in quotes, paper that gets published must start with the sentence, COVID-19 is a severe acute respiratory syndrome caused by SARS-CoV-2 virus. And then you can continue to present some other arguments. So this very sentence of the beginning of any paper nowadays is fraudulent. There is no COVID-19 and it's not caused by any SARS-CoV-2 virus. This is not to say that people are not getting ill. And as I showed, there is a very good explanation. People get ill when they are poisoned. And very strange things happen when people get poisoned. They either die or they respond to treatments that are completely don't make sense in the context of a viral infection, such as L-arginine or N-acetylcysteine, for that matter, or steroids. Now, steroids prove to be life-saving. Now, what do steroids do? They weaken the immune system. So if you got a viral infection and you take steroids, you're supposed to die quicker, right? Because you have not, your immune system is being suppressed. What happened in reality? People got better quickly. So the best treatment that I found for myself when I was poisoned was a combination of steroids and N-acetylcysteine. I could have, just... also used maybe nitric oxide or L-arginine, but all these, what's common to all of these is that they reduce inflammation and fight toxicity. So
yes, but Shimon, if we can convince enough people that there was no pandemic, that COVID-19 in inverted commas was a failure of diagnosis. It was a fraudulent diagnosis. There was no way of diagnosing it. There was a PCR test and all the other tests that came later. The PCR test we know was fraudulent. The others are equally fraudulent, I'm told, by people who know. And then you've got the clinical diagnosis, which is how things should be diagnosed. And you back it up with the result of a test if you feel you need that. At least that's how we were taught medicine should be practiced. So the clinical diagnosis, there wasn't a single symptom which was pathognomonic, in other words, peculiar to COVID-19.
Absolutely. And I think this
But
is...
then people say, oh, yes, but they were gasping for breath, you know. Well, there are plenty of other diseases where you end up gasping for breath, particularly when you've been psychologically tortured into a state of Stockholm syndrome and you can't trust your doctors.
I absolutely agree. What I showed up to this point was a plausible explanation for how people could have been poisoned, and poisoning does tend to cause reduced blood oxygenation in many ways. So it could be that people were getting sick and some were actually dying, but not of any viral infection. And in fact, Stephen, clinical diagnosis was being confiscated, I think, for the first time in history, from the hands of medical doctors, sure, and given to some underground laboratory, unnamed laboratory,
absolutely,
were doing fake PCR tests and telling people that they are ill, even if they were asymptomatic. Mm. So for the first time in history, you could have been declared by your country as statutory ill and statutory infectious and statutory dangerous, even if you had no disease whatsoever, because some fake PCR said so.
And Shimon, I've got emails from the European Medicines Agency. When I asked them how they had approved the test, they said that the test, and how many people were producing these tests? Hundreds of manufacturers in Europe alone. So the European Medicines Agency couldn't possibly approve all those manufacturers' tests. I've got that in an email. Unbelievable. So do you see the point?
Yeah,
They never approved the tests. That's very important.
When the WHO broke word to the world that there was a SARS-CoV-2 pandemic, within a month, I think, there was a publication of this fraudulent Drosten paper, and he came up with the primers for the PCR test. They were based on SARS-CoV-1, and that became the gold standard for diagnosing SARS-CoV-2. And what I found, and I think later other people confirmed that there was international commerce starting in 2017 of all these COVID-19 related products, including primers for PCR tests. And in fact, thermocycler PCR machines themselves were started shipping 2017. That was 2 years, more than 2 years before event 201, you know, the October 2019 event where Bill Gates and Klaus Schwab and Johns Hopkins Institute did this tabletop exercise of this new coronavirus preparing to come and hit us, which it did. And 2 months before that, a great person and personality died. His name was Carey Mullis. He was a Nobel Prize laureate. He was just, you know, nobody except he invented the PCR test. And he died of some unexpected pneumonia in August 2019. And that's very sad because we now have the death of Arne Burkhardt, who I wanted to get to this point to show you to discuss the proteins and so on, on which I talked with him but it's taking longer. And this is a very important discussion. So I agree both with Charles and with you. I think we are discussing here for the first time things that should have been discussed long ago. So not only was the PCR fake, but its inventor conveniently died 2 months before the breakout of COVID. Okay, so, yeah.
And he didn't like Fauci either. He said of Fauci, I've got it on video, and it looks like Kerry Mullis, he said, he doesn't know anything about anything. And I would say that to his face, he said. So he really hated Fauci because he knew what Fauci was doing. Yeah. And actually, he won the Nobel Prize in 1993 for his discovery in 1983, or for his invention, if you like, of the PCR technique, not the test.
That's right. And he not only that, but rather he insisted that this should never become a test.
Absolutely.
This was invented as a tool, not for any diagnostic purposes, but rather for amplification of small amounts of DNA.
He actually said, he's very careful with his word. He said, it should never be used. My technique should never be used for a diagnostic test for a viral illness.
Right.
Quote. He also said he couldn't get Montagnier even to verify his statement, which was, like you said, he had to put at the beginning of his paper. And the statement was the HIV virus is the probable cause of AIDS. And he couldn't find a citation for that statement. And he went around the world shouting his mouth off about that and eventually got to Montagnier in Paris. And Paris couldn't do it. But Montagnier couldn't do it either. And he walked away from Mullis and all his colleagues, Montagnier's colleagues, and they were looking surprised. Yeah.
Yeah. So I can assure you, Stephen, that there is no such thing as an HIV virus, and there is no such thing as a SARS-CoV-2 virus, and in fact, no virus whatsoever. And we had quite prominent deaths, including that of Montagnier in that period. People who were breaking away from narratives that were dear to the establishment. And I truly hope that I'm not as important as these people, that no such harm would come to me. But I think I'm asking the right questions and trying to give the right answers.
Absolutely.
So there could have been a mass poisoning, and I'm sure there was. And not only that, this mass poisoning became even more apparent when the rollout of the COVID-19 injectables began, because then people really started to die en masse. So people are being poisoned. They have been during the Spanish flu. And I think I've already given two talks, and I pasted the link to my research and video on that. Anybody wants to familiarize themselves with what happened during the Spanish flu and the toxic injections of that time, they can do so. So I can continue with the presentation and...
Yep.
So I here examined the theory that the delivery vehicle, that is the lipid nanoparticles, nobody ever demonstrated them, by the way, but they are said to be in there. But there are claims that they are very toxic and they result in deaths of mice. And this is the video. I can paste the link to that in the chat by Gabriela Segala, who demonstrated that these lipid nanoparticles are designed to disintegrate, or maybe not designed, but this is the effect. And then obviously no such delivery of mRNA can take place, but the lipids can, the toxic makeup of these lipids can spill out into the bloodstream, and it's not very good, is it? So let's move on to try to find a better model for what's going on here. And, you know, let's see. I'll pause that. What I want to talk about is that we have been told that there is something called spike protein, which is some fictitious protein that is associated with the original virus, and this spike protein becomes the desired antigen, and the purpose is making the host produce this particular protein so that the body can create antibodies for that protein, thereby conferring some kind of immunity. So all these people who got injected with this should be immune, and then we saw that they are getting much sicker. Now, all this rubbish about the spike protein and mRNA and all of this got me thinking, what's going on here? Do you want to inject, do you want people to develop protein antibodies to this spike proteins? Why don't you inject the antibodies? There is a simple answer to that. Antibodies are non-specific. Nobody ever recovered by injecting antibodies. Why don't you inject the spike protein itself? Oh, that's very simple, because it's deadly. So you want to make the host produce. How do you control how much the host is producing? Now, the thing is that the so-called patent for mRNA technology is a hoax. There is such a patent, I think. But the technology itself has never been demonstrated to work. So it's a fake technology. It's a fake narrative. Unless we go back to using bacteria. And I'm going to show you how. But before we do that, I want to show you. Suddenly, there were claims by embalmers, and let me just show you some images here, saying that they've been pulling out of dead bodies things that look like tissue samples that they have never seen before the so-called vaccination campaign. So they thought these were strange blood clots, and I'm going to show some graphic images. I hope you look away if you feel uncomfortable. So we started seeing all these either sausages or pieces of calamari or whatever. It has a few nicknames being pulled out of the bodies of dead victims of the COVID-19 injectables. Now, the thing that struck me when I first saw them, two things struck me. First was that there was not a single pathologist in the entire world that was willing, who was willing to step forward and discuss these things. The first one who did, and he said to me in a meeting, I acknowledge this, and I acknowledge that these are not normal, was the late Professor Arne Burkhardt. And I was pleasantly surprised when he said that, and as I was pleasantly surprised when he acknowledged my hypothesis about the production of proteins. This is from embalmer Richard Hirschman. And these are all, as you can see. Does this look like blood clots to you? So it took me a while, but when I looked at those for a long time, I was able to connect the dots. So I'll tell you what these are. I don't have proof, but I have presented this hypothesis to Arne Burkhardt. I have all the scientific papers, And 2 weeks later, sadly, he was no longer with us. And I can assure you that he was very healthy. He was healthier than me, in fact. So these look to me like polymers of protein. This is what they are. And there are many examples of such similar proteins, like connective tissue, you know, collagen and elastin, and other proteins that can become polymers. And this is what this is. This is not blood. So why were people starting to produce these sausages of proteins in their blood? And I'm going to pause this because I want to switch to another folder and show you some more images, this time of people who are still alive. And you will see why we need to connect the dots here. So again, some graphic images. These were pulled of people who are still with us, but were injected or inoculated. So again, maybe this looks like blood. To me, it looks like more like a tissue, so some kind of meat, maybe an organ. But this was actually pulled off blood vessels of people. These images were all provided to me by some woman who is still alive. Most of these images were taken from her body, so of structures from her body or blood vessels, but she took some control images of other people, some of them not injected. So what you can see is that this looks like reddish or something, but there is a protruding whitish thing, and whitish yellowish thing, which is clearly not blood, but it was taken from people's veins. So what is it doing there? You can see this gelatinous yellowish thing. I'm going to skip quickly through some of the images. And these are syringes that she took off her own blood, and she had strange foreign things floating on top of her blood, with some with these structures inside of them. So it became apparent that this is not ordinary blood. And again, you can see this gelatinous thing here. Let's move quickly. So what are these structures? And when you accept that these are polymers of proteins, you realize, and it struck me immediately, what if there is, in fact, a technology for manufacturing of exogenous proteins in the human body? But we are not dealing with one unique spike protein, in quotes, but many, multiple proteins, some of which could be responsible for the polymerization and the creation of these clots. And then I talked to Arne Burkhardt, and I told him, look, you need to stop looking for this spike protein, start looking for multiple proteins. Because if they can make one, they can make many. Now add to that the findings by the EMA and other research, and Kevin McKernan, that the mRNA that was found in the injectables was not a single unique mRNA. In fact, there were many aberrations. And mysteriously, when they submitted all these filings for licensing this, they said, yeah, there is some production process irregularities. So there is some noise around this distinct spike of the spike protein. And we have maybe multiple fragments of our different RNA, and it didn't bother them. These fragments could have coded for many other peptides and proteins, and it didn't test any of this. And then Kevin McKernan came up with plasmids. So not only is there RNA in the mRNA injectables, there is lots and lots of DNA. And in fact, most of it is plasmids. And plasmids each can contain genetic material that codes for multiple proteins. And there could be many plasmids. So it was clear to me that we are dealing, in fact, with many different proteins that are being synthesized in the human body. And the title spike protein was just intended to mislead and deceive. And some of these proteins could be responsible for creating meat-like tissues inside people's arteries. And I'm going to show you the nanotechnology bit that explains how can all of this can be inserted in an injection injected into the human body. And synthetic biology part. So explained that that there could be many proteins, I want to show you how this could be achieved. Let's see, where is the okay. Stephen and Charles, if you at any point you think that we should break this presentation into two, and
another 10 minutes is very good, Shimon. What you're showing is most instructive.
Okay. So I started looking into the ways of synthesizing proteins. And I found that there is a common practice in laboratories. This practice is called cell-free protein synthesis, or CFPS. This is how they manufacture proteins in the lab. And not only can they manufacture any protein in the lab, here is an example of there's a website of a company called BioLabs. And you can purchase just any custom protein from them. And if you look at this thing here, they are boasting solutions for expression of difficult proteins. So some proteins are difficult now, but nevertheless, they can make them and deliver them to you. So what I want to show you is a user's guide to cell-free protein synthesis, because this is how they synthesize any protein in the lab. And this is going to blow you away. So let's go to the charts. And this is cell-free protein synthesis. What do you do in the lab? You take bacteria. It could be other organisms, but single cell bacteria are ideal. You put them in some reactor and you have growth. I can enlarge this. Perhaps. We have growth of bacteria, and then we harvest them, and we have lysis. And this lysis is very important because this breaks the cells of the bacteria, and then this becomes cell-free. But what goes through are the guts or the extracts of the bacteria. And this, they called it post-lysis processing. And here you have the cell extracts or bacterial extracts in this test tube. And the protein expression is obtained by adding DNA template energy and other cofactors into the cell extract. And this is presumably the part of the bacteria that is capable of expressing the proteins. There's no longer the bacteria themselves, but the guts that can synthesize proteins remain. And then you incubate, you purify, and you get your purified proteins. I think in this case, they're talking about green fluorescent proteins, but this is true in general for any proteins whatsoever. So this is how proteins are produced in the lab. By bacteria extracts add energy. I can tell you now that this energy is in the form of 5G radiation. In fact, I'll show you, or if we still have time. And then salts, cofactors, you know, we need some nucleotides and so on, and we can have proteins. What's interesting about this is this. They've tested what organisms and cells are ideal for this kind of synthetic cell-free protein synthesis. And who's number one? So by far, the most efficient organism on Earth is E. coli bacteria here in this column. And the first time we encounter human cells, and in fact, these are not human cells, the HeLa cells, these are cancer cell lines named after Henrietta Lacks. These are not ordinary human cells. So you can see that they are much less efficient, even these very sick and very prolific cells that are very good at producing proteins with respect to human cells are an order of magnitude weaker than E. coli bacteria. So it became clear to me that human cells are not a good substrate for expressing proteins, unlike the fraudulent and criminal narrative of the COVID injections. So it's much more plausible that the proteins in the body are expressed by E. coli bacteria. The missing link was to show, well, I showed you that this is in a lab. This is, you can't have inject a test tube to the body. So what you need to do is show that this can be miniaturized and injected to people. And I did just that. I just need to find the before I do that, maybe I should go through. This is a sister paper. Also, cell-free protein synthesis applications. And there's cell-free gene expression in Nature. I think this is also an important paper. What are the physical stimuli for cell-free protein synthesis? And if you go straight to this chart here, figure one, you can see that these can be the stimulus can be either of by light, temperature, electric field, or magnetic field. And these two can be conveniently combined in electromagnetic field, which is another name for electromagnetic radiation. And why do these cell bacterial extracts require energy from the outside for the production of protein? It's simple, because when you do the lysis and you take the extracts from bacteria, they lose their mitochondria. They have no, there's no more self-energy supply. So you need to supply the energy from the outside. And this is how it's done. And finally, here is the missing link. And the title of this article, it's from 2013, is Microcompartmentalized Cell-Free Protein Synthesis in Semi-Permeable Microcapsules. So this is the paper that says how to transfer this laboratory technology into microcapsules. And microcapsules could be injected. And here is what they're made of. Something that coats alginate. For the sake of conciseness, so I can show you what's alginate as well, but this doesn't really matter. What really matters is that you know that there is the technology to insert these things into, where was this article? Into the human body by injection. And I want to show you how it looks. So Stephen and Charles, I may need to break the presentation into two because the discussion is so important and so much material. This is how this is being encapsulated into these semi-permeable membranes. And you can see there is a DNA and there is this substrate and the protein synthesis system. There's an inflow of substrate and an outflow of reaction byproduct, which is the protein, right? So with a simple injection, you can inject people with a laboratory that can synthesize synthetic proteins. And how does it do that? It uses a DNA library. And for reference, I want to say that any RNA is potentially a DNA after undergoing reverse transcription. So don't let that fool you. Basically, it's DNA. And you have a library. So you can decide, predetermine which DNA strands or types or phenotypes you want to include in your library. And then there could be many such proteins. Inject all of this, and let's look at some images. This is how the microcapsules look like. This is microscope images of these semi-permeable microcapsules. And why is this important? So Stephen and Charles, I want to consult with you whether to present my microscopy image showing just these structures and the bubbling, or should we leave some for something for next time and open this for a discussion?
Maybe I think we've got 35 minutes left. I think you've raised so many discussable issues. I think we can absolutely have another conversation examination in another session. Shimon, Stephen? That's my recommendation. We go to questions. We've got a number of hands up already.
Let me stop here, and maybe I'll just finish by just showing you my microscopy findings of these semi-permeable structures. This is from a Pfizer. You can't see it yet because I need to share. So these are my microscopy findings from a Pfizer, from the Pfizer vials. So this is clearly looks exactly as the images that I've just shown you in this paper. And I can also show you other images, but we'll reserve this for next time, of how these things actually function and how these things can actually also be assembled into larger structures that start producing proteins en masse. And we can see this production process in real time. So let me stop here. Thank you.
Very good. Very good. All right. We've got four hands up, but Stephen goes first. Stephen, are you there? Or we'll start with Lex. He's gone somewhere. Okay. Thank you, Shimon. Amazing amount of research and thinking. And thank you for your openness. And for those who don't know you, who are watching this recording, it's a great deal of research that you have done and thinking and each time you use a word, I'm going, wow, that's interesting. What do words actually mean, particularly if we don't know what a man is or a woman is? So when we start, even semi-permeable, you know, what does semi-permeable mean? So, Stephen, yeah, you first, and then we've got other hands up.
So, Shimon, if you can give quick answers, otherwise we're not going to have time. So I noticed when you were speaking that you talked about the National Institutes of Allergies and Respiratory Diseases.
Infectious. This is what...
I mean infectious diseases. Yeah, I've written wrongly here. Sorry. Yes, sorry. I meant infectious diseases. So isn't that interesting that they've got an institute with all that money for allergies and infectious diseases? I just wondered, when did that name come about? When did the institute come about? And in particular, when did that name come about? Because I think it's very interesting that the allergies and the infectious diseases are lumped together, when the allergies could be caused by, you know, the injectables, as you call them, all the injectables, you know, or many of them. So what do you think about that? And do you know when that name came about?
Well, Stephen, allergies exist. You know, some people...
Yeah, I'm not saying they don't, but I'm just interested because, of course, so they're interested in virology. We know that. Why are they interested in virology? So that they could push these so-called vaccinations. What do we think vaccinations cause? Well, they may cause allergies and other stuff. So I just wonder, is that nefarious too? Was that done intentionally? And when did it happen?
I believe so. I believe it started in the book 1984 by George Orwell, which was written in 1948. And there are, you know, ministries. There is a ministry of plenty, a ministry of truth. And the job entrusted in the ministry of truth is to provide lies. So
absolutely.
So it could be that
But Shimon, I don't know whether you understand my question. Why are allergies in this, you know, why are allergies and infectious diseases lumped together?
I think nefariously, Stephen.
Sure, I think so.
People could be sensitive to bee stings, and there is some very mild toxin, but some people could be very sensitive, could create a very dangerous allergic reaction. Is this an infection? Would you say, Stephen, that bee stings are infectious diseases?
So what I'm trying to say...
Hell are these two lumped together?
Exactly.
For nefarious purposes.
Yes, exactly. So it's occurred to me before, but only today did I think, very strange that allergies and infectious diseases are lumped together, and they've got this massive entity in the United States with huge amounts of money. But allergies are there. Very interesting. And I have thought that before, but I hadn't fully realized the significance of it. So we need to find out when that came about and who was behind it. If there was another name before, then what was that name? And why was it changed? And who pushed for the change? I just bring that up. So I hope other people will kind of like, because I'll forget it probably. Who is carrying on the work which Professor Burkhardt said he would do to, he thought that what you were suggesting needed to be investigated. I don't think he's the kind of guy, well, I don't know, I haven't met him, but I wouldn't imagine that he's the kind of guy who would agree with you just to be polite. So who is going to do that work? It's important that someone actually does the work, which we all think that Professor Burkhardt would have wanted to do himself. Do you understand me?
Sure. That's a good question, Stephen. So there were two stages to Professor Burkhardt's response to these blood rubbery calamari-like blood clot. First of all, he didn't address them at all, just like all other pathologists in the world. And then at some point, he started to say, we must address, okay, I'm convinced, these are not normal. That was the first stage.
Mm.
And it was a very significant stage. First time ever, the steps forward, a pathologist. I don't think he did this work himself. I think he was a front man for, because he was retired, right? So there were other pathologists in Germany for whom he was a front man. And he said, we need to look into this. This is absolutely...
Oh, I think he was, he went back to work, as I understood it. But
no, Masha... I don't think so. But he was maybe having meetings with some other pathologists who did the work. And that was the first stage. So he said, we need to address this.
Well, he was the front man, wasn't he? He was the public man, public face, if you like, together with Sukrit Bhakti, as I understand it. But he was in another country, wasn't he? Which country was that? I can't remember. He was in when the pandemic started, the so-called pandemic. And then he went back to Germany. He reinstated his license so that, as I understood it, he could work as a pathologist. And Sukrit Bhakti was, yes, I agree, he could be the front man, but why did he need his license if he was just the front man?
I apologize, Stephen. I'm not familiar with the technical location details and so on. But I know that he was an established pathologist. He was a father figure. It was a
well, Ryan Cole would certainly know, Shimo. So if we make this short, Ryan can answer this question as to what Anna was doing.
So before Ryan answers this, let me just address the second part. So the second part, the first part was that he said, okay, I acknowledge we need to address these issues. And he was the first ever pathologist, because these poor embalmers were forever looking for some pathologists to address these. They couldn't find any.
So they couldn't find a pathologist who would do any damned postmortems. So as I understand it, Professor Burkhardt was the only one in the world who actually did what he should have done in a so-called pandemic as a pathologist. The key person in a pandemic, if it was a pandemic.
He didn't do the autopsies himself, but he was the one who presented the horrifying results to the world in conferences and in groups such as this one, because what he showed was extensive tissue damage with infiltration of neutrophils and all sorts of grave results that led to deaths, and organ damage, for all sorts of organ, heart, or the myocarditis, or the liver.
Yeah.
And even the brain and the testes
But Shimon, the point I'm making is that he was the only pathologist in the world. Oh, apart from Ryan Cole, who was on the call. I don't know whether he still is. Who was doing?
He's here, Stephen. He's here.
Yes. So as far, and maybe Ryan Cole can correct me, but as far as I understand it, Professor Burkhardt was doing what all the pathologists in the world should have been doing. But did not do, yes. And that's unforgivable, because all pathologists must have been aware that in a pandemic, you don't get told as a pathologist that you can't do post-mortem examinations or autopsies, as they say in America. So we've done that. But Ryan Cole is welcome to speak in a second.
And not only that, Stephen, Arne Burkhardt was able to demonstrate that this tissue damage was caused by the injections. So it couldn't have resulted from some imaginary virus having this spike protein in it, because he couldn't find any other proteins such as the nuclear capsid of this said virus.
It's only
the spike protein, or some what's called the spike protein.
It's a pity in a way that while he was alive, that he limited himself to the information which I think came from the criminals that about the spike protein, and that he didn't have an open. Well, you don't. I don't know. You know. Oh, he possibly did have an open mind.
We stop
mind.
This conjecture. We've got Ryan here who worked closely with Burkhardt.
So hang on a minute. Yes, but hang on a minute. Ryan knows a lot of things, but even Ryan needs help with, and I need help as well, with lines of thought, because sometimes something important comes up because of one thought that flashes through your mind, and it only needs one mind. So I wanted to ask you, Simon, my last question, this is, we've been told about the spike protein, lipid nanoparticles, mRNA. How do we know that those three things, just limited to those three things, how do we know that those are definitely in these injections? And even if we do know that they're in the injections, allegedly, how do we know that they're in all the batches?
Oh, we definitely know that they are not in all the batches. So I guess we would have to wait to part two of my presentation, because I realize that I have too much information packed into an attempt to do it in one go.
But she so might...
we know that there is great variability between the batches, and some batches cause a lot of side effects or adverse events, as they are called, and even deaths, whereas others do not. And or it could be that the time frame for the adverse events to happen varies a lot. So some batches cause deaths within 2 weeks, and some people die after 2 years. So we don't know.
But Shimon, I'm just trying to get. So I'm actually supporting you. So if the knowledge of the spike protein, about which everybody talks about as if it definitely exists, you know. I'm not happy that it does exist, because I've been told by some people who were telling everybody what the adverse effects of the contents of the vaccines, in inverted commas, were, that they only knew that these things were in the vaccines from the CDC, the FDA, and Big Pharma, as I understand it. So why on earth, as I said to those people, nameless, I said to those people, why on earth would we believe the criminals about anything? So if they tell us that there's the spike protein and that's the problem, and everybody in the world agrees on it, who knows about spike protein, then is that true or isn't it? Is it possible that it's not true?
Good and legitimate question. So I was initially convinced that there was no mRNA or any genetic material coding for any toxic proteins, and that all the toxicity was embedded inside the vials themselves. And we know that there is, and I did that in my previous presentation, and partially here we showed how toxic the delivery platforms or these lipids are. But I now think, having seen these calamari or sausages thing, that this fake spike protein narrative is fake. Excuse me. Because suppose they can synthesize the spike protein using these extracts of bacteria. I showed you that, you know, just by selecting a larger library, they can make any number of peptides and proteins.
Sure.
So by getting everybody to talk about the spike protein,
they hide all the other possibilities.
Exactly. And they hide the calamari blood clots, and they hide other lipids or amyloids. You can find all sorts of rubbish names for many things that are unexplainably created nowadays and are found in people, and could all result from the same nefarious synthetic biology technology that is embedded in the nanotechnology.
So, Shimon, I think that's what's called a limited hangout. So you admit to certain things which are bad, but they're not as bad as the reality. And it's the same thing with the gain of function. I think the gain of function narrative is a fraud, and it's put there, it's put about, even though it's illegal, highly illegal gain-of-function research in the United States and even outside the United States with United States money. They put it about because it bolsters the narrative that deadly pandemics are possible when I don't think they are.
Absolutely, Stephen. This limited hangout methodology is conspicuous here. I think I totally agree with you.
Sure. So are you absolutely convinced that spike proteins are in these injections?
Well, according to their narrative, the spike proteins are not in the injections, but the genetic...
Oh, sorry, I meant that. The ability to produce them through the mRNA, yes, exactly.
So, yeah, I'm convinced that there is a lot more proteins being coded for in the genetic material that is found in some of the injections, not all. And those that don't have the toxic... instruction sets contain other sorts of nanotechnology that is not less harmful.
Excellent, Shimon. Thank you very much.
So, Ryan, comment, please, before we go to Lex, just on Burkhart.
Yes, real quick. Dr. Burkhart technically never retired. I want to thank Masha for posting in the chat there. Dr. Burkhart worked until the day he passed, and he worked in many capacities over his career, and in terms of, you know, research, yes, he was focused on the damage of the spike protein in the tissues. I do agree with Shimon. You know, obviously we have some points of difference. That's fine, but I agree that it's not just the spike protein being produced in the body. There was a study that came out of BioNTech showing that the spike protein should weigh 141 kilodaltons, and I have a gel electrophoresis from their own research showing that it was producing proteins in cell culture that were 100 and 190 kilodaltons. So I agree with Shimon, these genetic sequences are producing more than just a spike protein, and that's why I think we're seeing varied autoimmune responses in a lot of individuals. From the vials that I examined, and I could do a presentation, I worked with some physicists.
You're welcome
Austria.
To do that, Ryan. I meant to email you, but I forgot again. Oh, so you're welcome
okay.
to do it.
At some other point, yeah, I'd be happy to do a presentation on what's in the vials, what's not in the vials. Some had high concentrations of mRNA, others had lower concentrations, et cetera, et cetera. Definitely plasmid contaminations. That's another lecture altogether as well. But, you know, the spike protein itself, you know, when the body does produce it, and we do have evidence of that from the pathology studies and Dr. Burkhart's work and some of the work I've done, and eventually I'll publish here. I've just been on the road too much. I'm finally home and back in the laboratory. But, you know, the harm of the spike protein is obviously excessive in the human body, and it lasts a long time. There are papers showing that those that got the shots produce a lot more spike protein for a longer period of time than those with a, quote, natural infection, whatever you want to call that. So it's important to realize that, yes, this was an impure product. They changed modalities of production to process number two, which was grown in E. coli early on, which has caused a lot of the contamination and a lot of the harm. I agree with Shimon. Some batches were a lot worse than other batches. About 5% of the batches account for 80% of the harms. So I think that's an important note. So, I mean, there's so much that we're still learning. The lipid nanoparticles from research for the last two decades, we know lipid nanoparticles are toxic and shouldn't be put into the human body because they go everywhere. They were designed to carry chemotherapy to the brain. They cross the blood-brain barrier. They obviously cause neurologic harm in addition to whatever message they're carrying genetically. So there's so much that, you know, Dr. Burkhart did. As to the clots, yes, these are proteins, and you know, the body has a lot of proteins in circulation. Technically, the blood is a connective tissue. If you go to embryology, blood is considered a connective tissue. So, you know, these clots, and I have 33 of them in my lab, the postmortem ones, but it's important to note that there are a lot of these extracted premortem as well. Individuals that are lucky enough to still be alive, that surgically they've had these large clots extracted. So I have some of those as well. What we're doing now, and I'm working with some other pathologists on this, we're doing X-ray crystallography on these proteins. I think it's very important for anyone here to look at the work of Dr. Pretorius out of South Africa, Dr. Kell out of the UK, leaving one out, Jordan Vaughn in Alabama. So there are a lot of docs that have been looking at these. Yes, they're amyloid-like, AA amyloid type proteins, not your typical beta pleated sheet amyloid from light chain disease and lymphomas. It's a different type of amyloid. There's a lot of glycoprotein, but it's basically an enzymatic process. The spike protein in the absence of platelets will induce proteins to clump together. And if you look at these clots, even though they're postmortem, usually what we see is what we call the lines of Zahn. So if these had formed postmortem, we would see this layering like a tree ring line. We don't see that in these clots. There's a lot of fibrin in these clots. There's a lot of different amino acids, a lot of proteins, a lot of glycoproteins. And in some of them, we can identify the spike protein. In others, we haven't. So the spike protein is a triggering process. It's the catalyst, but it doesn't have to be there in all of the clots. Dr. Burkhart, I have his slide set. We have some medium-sized clots in pulmonary vessels where the clots are full of spike protein. And so there are so many different mechanisms that are, you know, it's peeling the onion in terms of mechanisms of what's happening. And I do think if we look at the study out of Stanford that showed, you know, those with, quote, asymptomatic COVID, there was a predisposing genetic type within those individuals that never, ever had a symptom, but, you know, tested positive and whatnot. But at the same time, there's going to be, I think, in a couple of years, we're going to do a genetic look back and be able to find who were the clot formers versus those who weren't. Not everybody's forming these clots. Not everybody should be panicked. But at the same time, we're going to find that there's a genetic clotting predisposition in certain individuals that would predispose one to forming these type of clots over other individuals. So that's my, you know, and again, thanks to Shimon, I know we don't agree on everything, but he did bring up some very good points and I want to validate some of those. So I'd be happy to, it's not my talk today. So I just want to bring up those important points and again, honor the work of Dr. Burkhart and the wonderful things that he did in terms of, you know, where we are at this point and continuing to move forward with the research and trying to prove the insidious harms that have been caused by this horrible injection program around the world. Thank you.
Ryan, can I just ask you very quickly, are you the type of pathologist who does postmortem examinations or not?
I used to, I mean, back when I was in bigger facilities, but in my private laboratory, unfortunately, I don't. So the autopsy materials I've received from around the world have been done by other coroners and medical examiners. And then I received the tissues for review in my laboratory. I agree with you guys. It's horrible that autopsies were discouraged very early on by Fauci and the powers that be. And then that message carried around the world. And so, you know, you can't find what you don't look for. And I think that was their goal, was to hide the harms by scaring people, threatening people. If you do an autopsy, you know, we can take away your license or kick you out of our hospital or kick you out of our pathology group, et cetera. People were terrified to do what should have been done from day one.
Absolutely.
All right. Thank you, Ryan. Shimon, any further comments to Ryan before we get to Lex?
Yeah. So- yeah, can you hear me?
Yep.
Yes.
Yeah, so thank you, Ryan. So I'm glad that we are in some agreement. And just I'd like to say that as per my presentation, there is absolutely no relationship to the genome of the victim. This is a genetic library that is being injected, and these proteins would be expressed regardless of what the genetic makeup of the victim is. So there is no susceptibility of a portion of the population to develop these sausages in their blood. It's simply whether they are injected with these toxins or not. This is all it takes. Simple as that.
All right. Thank you.
I would agree to a degree. I think the ability for one to break down fibrin at an adequate rate, or the missing, clotting factors or breakdown of clotting factors varies from individual to individual. So that's what's so critically important is some people, you know, with a factor five Leiden gene profile are going to have, you know, different clotting problems compared to somebody with, you know, other, you know, predisposing or protective mechanisms just from a pathophysiologic point of view. So thank you. I appreciate that.
Yeah, there could be differences in the ability of the different people to metabolize these toxins.
Correct.
I agree with, that. But the very creation of these toxins in the first place is all related to what they've been injected with.
Well, I agree. Yeah, I mean, this toxic injection, I agree with you. Yes.
Thank you.
All right. Where's Lex gone? Did he drop out? He might have. If he drops, if he comes back in, he might have had to go. So, John.
Thank you very much for the presentation. And two things. One, one's a style thing, and then I'll get to my question. So you state that when they state that SARS-CoV-2 exists and viruses exist, they're crazy because they have no proof and that you know they don't exist. Do you see the flaw in that logic there? You're saying the same thing. You're just saying the negative. Like, I know they don't exist. They're wrong when they say they exist. I mean, it's, I don't know if they exist or not, but the models exist. And I don't want to get into a discussion of viruses. I just from a tactical and strategic communication point of view, when you state something so provocative, you put the listeners, everybody on the panel, they're either with you or against you instead of, you know, I don't believe they exist. Maybe you do. And just different nuanced conversation. Now, to the point, you said bacterial pneumonia does not exist. I'm not a biologist or a doctor. I just have a question about biology. Thinking back to my school days, bacterium is an animal. And all animals will take in stuff and put out stuff. We put out whatever fecal matter. If you have some chicken and it's rotting, going bad, you it's got this slime on it. You can smell it. You can feel it. Same with steak and beef. Now, if you get a bacterium that's multiplying in your lungs, if it's multiplying and breeding, it's taking in nutrients and oxygen and producing fecal matter oozing outside the membrane of the bacterium, which is, that's the poison that your body's reacting to. You know, if the bacterium just multiplied on its own, your body would say, hey, man, symbiote. That's fine. But the fact that it's putting out poisons in your lung, your body's saying, no, we can't handle this. Let's put a bunch of goo in there in the form of a bunch of white blood cells. So this guy coughs up a bunch of green, whitish phlegm. Okay, that's bacterial pneumonia. Now, why do you say bacterial pneumonia doesn't exist? I'm not a biologist. I'm just asking to explain it to me, please. Thanks.
Okay, so first of all, this is not me who started saying this. And in fact, I've said this before in this group, but other people have come up with this idea before me that perhaps we have been lied to and viruses don't exist at all. And then I started doing my research, for example, on the work of Louis Pasteur and rabies and the Spanish flu. And I discovered that they were all hoaxes. Many people died because of these hoaxes sometimes, but there weren't any viruses involved anywhere. Now, this SARS-CoV-2 thing is quite easy because you will not find anywhere a sample of this virus. All you will find is supernatant samples of toxins taken from green African monkeys' kidney cells. So I beg of you to consider the fact that you have been lied to all these years and viruses don't exist after all. And I give the specific example, which I personally researched to show that these were all hoaxes. And I also suggest that the narrative that we are all, humanity, and every single one of us is under grave threat, is just to scare the guts out of us because it serves some purpose. So no, if we are going to die, it's going to be because we are being poisoned, not because some pathogen jumps us in a dark alley. This is not why people die. And it's always been like that. And this is why infectious disease don't exist. It's because disease, you can easily transfer your bacteria and your fungi to others, for example, by kissing or by sexual intercourse. In fact, some people kiss their cats and dogs, and there is an exchange of bacteria. There is never an exchange of disease. So not only that, many thousands of gut bacteria are known to be beneficial. And some people, you know, want to ferment vegetables and to pickle and you know, make sauerkraut and kefir or whatever. What do they use? They use bacteria and fungi for that purpose. No one gets killed in the process. No one gets ill. Some people get healthier. So the process of bacteria and fungi breaking down dead tissue, on the other hand, is so well documented that, in fact, this fate awaits each and every one of us, but only after we are dead, not while we are alive. Now, if we have some dead tissue in us, it could be lung tissue, it could be skin tissue, it could be any heart tissue, then, yeah, there will be bacteria and fungi there to break up this tissue. This is what they do. They break up dead tissue. They don't cause disease. And this is why I'm claiming that there is no such thing as infectious diseases. And we've all been lied to. And this is also refers to Stephen's original question. So, where the hell did this office of for allergies and infectious disease come from? Who made this up? Who came up with this?
So just my original question was bacterial. So you're saying that Staphylococcus, Streptococcus, and other bacteria that invade the lungs don't cause bacterial pneumonia, that it's something else, even though that we put it under a microscope, we know that they've multiplied, we know that they excrete bad stuff that our body reacts to and fills up our lungs. I guess I don't understand how you can say that bacterial pneumonia doesn't exist. I'm still lost.
Not only am I saying that, you can easily check me. There is, in addition to pneumonia, there is another disease called pneumonitis. And if you test and look this up, you can see that pneumonitis is any pneumonia that is not caused by bacteria. So we know that pneumonia could well be caused by other things other than bacteria. In fact, some people get pneumonia after too many chest x-rays because this kills tissue and or causes inflammation. And this is what pneumonia is.
All right. We've had the expression of views. We're almost out of time. We've got three more hands up. Thank you, John. Great question, great conversation. Tom, Master Jack, and then we've got to go.
Oh, you want me next?
Yep.
Okay. So J.J. Cooey has been a great teacher to me, although I don't understand it entirely by any means. One of the precepts, I think, is that RNA cannot exist just free-floating. It'll be destroyed by the immune system just rapidly. I think the same thing is true for DNA. So you need some sort of a transport mechanism. That's what the nanolipid protein, the LNP particles are. And I've heard about the contamination with a circular and linear DNA. And I'm thinking about this, I'm imagining the only way that can be effective if it's in the injections, if that too is inside the LNP particle. So moving on this, you're talking about these proteins that, and it could be more than one protein, not just the spike, or maybe not even the spike, but some other proteins. The mRNA narrative involves supports this idea of one to many, meaning one template of mRNA can create many spikes until that cell is destroyed by the immune system, because our body doesn't like that when we create foreign proteins. So eventually that cell gets destroyed, and then you have inflammation damage and so forth. So your narrative, however, seems to suggest that these proteins are already created in the injections, and so I would think you'd have a smaller number. So I guess I'm kind of looking for sort of a tutorial step by step on, like, how would one of these proteins get created? And if it is DNA, doesn't that DNA have to be protected? I'm aware that the plasm circular DNA can be used by bacteria to create perfect copies of that DNA so you can mass produce it. At least that's what J.J. Cooey is saying. I'm just looking for kind of like, it almost sounds like what you're suggesting is you couldn't get as much toxin if you're not actually using a manufacturing process of the body to create the toxins. Are you suggesting the body's not being used to create these, that they're pre-created in the injections? That's it.
Thanks for the question, Tom. No, there is some confusion. I said that I discovered that there is definitely some toxicity straight from the vials, but that I then discovered that there is the technology and there are the findings to suggest that synthetic biology from the injections in the bloodstream is manufacturing or expressing several proteins. And let me just show you again how this synthetic biology cell looks like. Here is what it looks like. So now, what I did suggest is that, in my opinion, it's not the host, it's not the human body itself, not the human cells that produced these proteins. And why? Because the literature, the scientific literature, shows that they have experimented with this for a long time, and they have discovered that E. coli bacteria, for example, as well as some plants and other organisms, are 10 or 100 times more efficient synthesizers of proteins. And this is why they want to inject these synthesizers and not use our own cells. And I want to remind you, unlike bacteria, which are all identical, a single cell organism, we are very complex. Look at my fingernail. Only my fingers can express the protein, the keratin that makes up the fingernails. There is no other single cell in my... You can try. You will not be able to make it. So we are very specialized. We comprise many specialized cells. They can't be easily manipulated. E. coli bacteria, on the other hand, easily can be. So this is what I'm saying.
So they're injecting bacteria then?
No.
And that's...
No. They're injecting encapsulated extracts from bacteria. So I'm sorry, maybe we need to do the presentation again. This is a very basic point. No, this is what's called cell-free protein synthesis. So the original bacteria are no longer there. Their guts are there.
Okay, I'll go back and review. I wasn't watching the entire thing. Thanks.
Yep, go back and review. All right, come on, we've got to keep moving. Masha, then Jack, and then we're going to go.
You're muted, Masha.
But now it should work?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. Just to complete, Arne Burkhardt did autospecies himself together with Savannah Bank. And then there was...
I'm sorry, he did what?
He did autopsies himself.
Yes, I know that. Oh, yes, exactly.
Yeah, he did it. there was a topic of this long blood clots or proteins pulled out of their bodies. There is actually a movie or video by Stu Peters, if I am not wrong, and I noticed the name he mentioned, that it was Anna Michalchia. So it seems someone does look into this.
She's a member of this group, Masha. We know her.
So someone does look into this or not?
I'm sorry?
Anna Michalchia did not look into these clots. She doesn't have the equipment or the qualifications to do that. She, I think at some point she suggested that these are hydrogel, which they are not, I can assure you. So my hypothesis, and I think Arne Buchart agreed, and I think even Ryan Cole here echoed some similar views, that these are proteins, and we yet have to find out how many and how diverse. And they are... They are polymerized. So they are not only proteins, there are chains of protein. This is why they form these rubbery clots.
I was just wondering, because I watched a movie about this, pretty long and disturbing on this. And I thought it was by Stu Peters. But talking of movie or talking of video, have you watched David E. Martin on May 28th? In the EU Parliament? I'm asking because he is very specific about coronavirus existing. He names dates and he names places and results. And I'm just putting a link which includes both his speech and his presentation, as well as the transcript of his speech. And I was now confused if the virus exists.
Masha, we know David Martin. He's presented to us. But Shimon, do you want to say anything about that?
Yeah, I wouldn't take David Martin too seriously.
I would. Okay.
Okay, go ahead and take him seriously. I think he knows a lot about patents.
Good. Okay, so a lot about patents, and yes, a number of us, Masha, have seen that presentation that David made to the EU, so there's the comment.
But the other good thing about David Martin is that he is very interested in the crime which has been committed and holding people to account for those crimes. But I'm afraid he's a little bit too invested in the gain-of-function narrative for my liking.
Absolutely, absolutely, Stephen. He's invested in fake narratives, and I'm all about dispelling...
But Shimon, we don't know that... So I'm not criticising him. I'm just saying, for my liking, he's a little bit... I don't know what's happening at the moment, Masha. Nobody does. And nobody with any sense does. Anybody who says, well, this is definitely right... is probably wrong, in my opinion.
All right, let's go. Jack.
And not wise either to say that you're definitely right and everybody else is definitely wrong. I think anything is possible at the moment.
Okay, well, let me comment quickly on David Martin. I mean, the thing that to me is important is he's tracked these patents back for about 20 years, and he says coronaviruses have been patented for a couple decades now. And you cannot patent something from nature, which means that it's been modified in a laboratory. We also know that that program was moved over to Wuhan from the University of North Carolina in 2015, when Obama prohibited any more gain-of-function research. So there's just a whole trail of crumbs that goes way back. But I like to kind of course, I'm a psychologist, so I want to look at the macro rather than micro level. And I think Stephen mentioned right at the beginning, or asked right in the beginning, and someone else along the way did too, where did the NIAID originate and why? Well, I'm an NIH-funded scientist myself, and so I happened to have looked that up at one point. And it was in the mid-50s that it originated. And why is that an important period? Well, it so happens that we use so-called germ warfare in the Korean War. And we actually inherited, about 1,600 Nazi scientists from Germany that we gave amnesty to from Nuremberg. And not only amnesty, but full employment in the United States at Fort Detrick and other bioweapons laboratories. And I think there is huge evidence that this whole COVID thing came out of our bioweapons program. Now, that original NID agency or institute had the Pentagon as one of its funding sources, in addition to the Department of Health. And that's very interesting, and that's still the case. They moved a lot of that over to DARPA, which gives it special confidentiality protection. So, and DARPA has been very much involved in the funding of this whole thing over at Wuhan. That's well documented. And during the Korean War, back in 1951, we were accused, and correctly so, of using germ warfare on North Korea and China. And that include dropping anthrax and cholera and plague on the population there. And we've been involved in germ warfare ever since. And to try to, now everybody's preoccupied with figuring this particular chapter out and all the biological dynamics of COVID or non-COVID or whatever the hell is in those vaccines. So they've got us all thinking about all of this, but they've been up to all of this for a long, long time. And that's something that you emphasize, Shimon. And this has been practiced for a long time. There have been many chapters, many experiments. There was the anthrax release after 9/11. There have been a whole series of variations on the coronavirus platform. And so I'm very interested in that. I'm interested in justice. I'm interested in the long term. I'm interested in holding people accountable rather than just trying to figure out how they're doing at this time. They're probably going there. This is another practice run because it hasn't been successful. So they're going to be back again trying to make it more and more successful. So anyway, I just want to bring that long view. And I think Shimon is absolutely right. It's been practiced for a long, long time, many chapters, many variations. And unless we put a stop to the whole program, it's just going to keep going.
Yeah. So, Jack, what you're saying is that investigating what's gone on in the last 3 years from a medical and scientific point of view is pointless if you're not aware of the history beforehand and the conclusions one should draw from a deep knowledge of that history. Is that right?
Well, yeah, they've got us all very focused on this because they scared the hell out of the whole population. So everybody's preoccupied with how the current murder program is operating, what the modus operandi are this time around. And it's been more effective than the last ones, although virtually nobody has actually died of COVID itself. I mean, the death rate attributed to COVID is minuscule, and that includes all the inflation of stats by the definition of COVID, suspected or laboratory confirmed, are all categorized the same, and even lab confirmed has been pointed out here, is based on a PCR test, which is invalid. And according to Kerry Mullis, he says you can find anything if you run enough cycles. And we ran by 40 cycles or something typically to come up with a positive finding. And he wouldn't go over 20 or 25 himself. So, and he conveniently died, of course, in 2019.
Yes, but not even to 2025, Jack, for the diagnosis of a viral disease.
Yeah, right. And that was...
Okay.
Anyway, that was what he said. I'm not going to question that. The point is, he said if you go up as high as we were going, 30, 35, 40, you can find anything and anyone. And
yeah.
The whole thing has been completely fraudulent in every dimension. And now that fortunately the public is waking up to that, And I was pleased to see a month or so ago that only 6% of the population in the United States are getting the booster, the newest iteration of booster. So we have to stop this. I'm very interested in the legal angle. There are lawsuits flying left and right now. We have to get these people and put them out of business. They're the ones who need to be quarantined. And we have to get serious about this and stop fooling around and stop obsessing about the details.
And maybe stop enjoying the summer, Jack.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Or winter in Charles's case.
But not while we forget the justice. We should never let go of this. We should dig our teeth in and not let go until these people are out of business. That includes Klaus Schwab and Bill Gates and so forth. They are criminals. But you see, the United States is a criminal organization. It has been all my life, and I'm as old as you are. It's been a criminal organization, and we have been lied to and lied to and lied to over and over from the time we dropped two atomic bombs on Japan, a country that was ready to surrender. You know, we are the great psychopaths of the world. When Martin Luther King said, "We are the greatest purveyor of violence on earth," he was murdered by the United States government exactly 1 year to the day from when he said that. And that was a message to the civil rights movement. Folks can sit anywhere in the bus you want. You can go into any lunch counter you want, but you don't screw around with the empire.
You don't screw around with what?
The empire.
Hmm.
The American empire.
Yeah.
You see, you don't screw around with us. And we have continued committing mass murder ever since.
Yeah.
And the American public has remained oblivious. There was no Gulf of Tonkin. There was no excuse for the Vietnam War. And according to the foreign minister of Vietnam after the war, he said, "We killed 3 million people."
Mm.
All we ever heard about was the 58,000 Americans who got killed.
So, Jack, you know, you hear a lot of plaudits, if you like, of the people who devised the Constitution of America. How did they not foresee that these people would find this loophole?
Well, I think some of them did. I mean, that's why we have a Bill of Rights, which was added afterwards by James Madison, which actually covers a lot. And I think in the last week when I was talking to the guest then, she said, "Oh, yeah, we're kind of looking to the United States because of that, because no other country has a strong Bill of Human Rights." It's called the Universal Declaration of Human Rights for everybody now, but nobody pays any attention to it. And the United States in particular, we don't pay any attention whatsoever to international law, to human rights. I mean, we go into...
I haven't heard a single human rights lawyer, in inverted commas, speak out about what's happened in the last 3 years. Not a single one.
So that's the right.
The lawyers who've spoken out aren't human rights lawyers. Isn't that amazing? Where are the human rights lawyers?
Well, I don't think they pay much attention to what's really going on. Their idea of human rights is protecting the black, brown, gay, lesbian, etc. These individual groups within the United States.
Yeah.
We can go out and kill all the brown people in the rest of the world, and they don't say a thing.
So the oppressed, allegedly oppressed minorities.
Yeah, well, look at Malcolm X was the first of the four seminal assassinations in the 1960s, 1964. Now, why was he assassinated by the U.S. government? Well, I think it was because he was going to Africa. And he was pointing out that the racism of the United States is not just in the United States. He was actually identifying with Patrice Lumumba, was murdered for was mm-hmm. the delusion that African resources actually belonged to Africans.
Yeah.
And it was the same thing that Gaddafi was murdered for by the American mm-hmm. Empire not too long ago. And nobody says a peep about it because somebody said he had you know, some sort of sexual deviation or whatever the excuse is. We go in and destroy.
He was effectively lynched, as I understand it, Jack.
We go in and destroy the most highly developed country in Africa, which had a human development index equal to Western Europe, and which had a very unique system of participatory democracy, and had its own currency, its own independent currency that was gold-backed, that he was planning to expand to all of Africa. He wanted to establish an African development bank that will put the IMF out of business in Africa. That's why he was murdered, and his country was destroyed. Sure. And Americans know nothing about any of this.
Mm. And then, of course, that's not, you've got Iraq as well. What happened in that? That was absolutely unbelievable. I know all about that. Well,
oh, yes, yes. That's right. And in fact,
no weapons of mass destruction.
It's just... And Gaddafi was manipulated the first time in going in to Iraq. He was manipulated by
April Glaspie. I know about that. So yeah. April Glaspie said, Saddam Hussein said to April Glaspie about 5 days before Saddam Hussein walked into Kuwait.
Yeah.
He said, what would America's view be of what, you know, he suggested kind of obliquely that, you know, an invasion of Kuwait by Iraq.
Saddam was claiming.
April Glaspie replied, America has no interest in Arab conflicts.
No positions.
No positions about Arab conflict.
And
so I remembered that for 20 years.
Yes,
or so.
Exactly. And Saddam was claiming that Kuwait was slant drilling into their country. That was a thin excuse to try to grab Kuwait.
Just in case people are listening and they don't understand that you are criticizing the United States, not because you hate the United States, but because you love the United States and you wanted to get back on track. That's correct, isn't it?
Good. All right. Well, you guys keep talking. We're well over 2.5 hours. You guys will talk all night. For those of you, this is just relentless. So the conversation will continue. Keep talking. Stephen, over to you to moderate. It's time is up, but Shimon can keep talking. Thank you, Shimon, for your presentation.
Thank you.
Anyway, to answer your question.
Thank you, Shimon.
Yeah, thank you, Shimon.
I feel that we need a second part. Just a quick addressing what you said, Jack. I don't think it's just the United States of America that's a criminal country. I think that the entire... All the countries in the world, or most of the countries in the world, are now compliant in this criminal activities. And, you know, you'll find that in Russia and China, Israel, Australia, all over the place, it's now governments, you know, just injecting toxins to their citizens and enforcing lockdowns and whatever. It's a globalist agenda now. It's not just the United States anymore.
No, absolutely. Yeah, but the United States...
All right, Jack, that's enough. We're going. I'm stopping the recording. Thank you, Shimon.
It's Sodom and Gomorrah, in short.
Yeah.